In this part of Focus, we will return to a subject that we actually talked about not very long ago, and that is Nigeria. We'll be talking at least in part about the elections that took place, the presidential election that took place this past weekend there in Nigeria. A winner has been officially declared in the presidential election. However, at the same time, international observers who were there watching the proceedings said that certainly there was widespread fraud and intimidation. The losers, the men who came in second and third, said that they are very unhappy. A lot of people have called for the election to be run again, and there is some question about exactly how all this would be resolved. We'll be talking a little bit about that, but also we want to talk this morning about the decision of the United States to create a new Pentagon command covering Africa. Something that was initially proposed last year in 2006 and is due to come into being officially next year in 2008. And we'll talk a little bit about this and about what it says about the way that the United States thinks of Africa and its strategic significance to this country. And for all of this, we will turn this morning to Paul Lubeck. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz, where he's also involved with the director of the Center for Global, International, and Regional Studies. He is, among other things, interested in Nigeria and has done work there. He'll be talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we do talk, questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, certainly people who are listening are welcome to call. The only thing we ask callers is that people just are brief as possible, so that we can keep the program moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone is welcome to call. Again, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Lubeck, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's talk here about what has happened over the last couple of days in Nigeria. As I said, there has been an official winner announced, the man who was the former vice president. There have been a lot of people who have, to say the very least, said that there was problems associated with the election. The two men who came in second and third are very unhappy, have talked about turning their followers out into the streets to protest the result. What if anything can be said at this point about now what happened this past weekend there?
Yeah, let me just remind readers the significance of Nigeria. It's 140 million people. Roughly one in five sub-Saharan Africans are Nigerian. It is a major energy supplier to the United States, oil and natural gas, made somewhere between 8 and 12% of American imports come from Nigeria, and it's a key strategic ally of the United States. The election was undertaken and directed by the president, Obasanjo, the former general, very close to American interests, both Clinton and Bush administrations. And he attempted to revise the Constitution to make himself president for life, as they say in Nigeria, last May, so he could continue for a third term. This was rejected by a popular mobilization of civil society groups, democratic activists, and the opposition parties, and the legislature voted against the amendments to the Constitution despite an alleged $1 billion expenditure to bribe the legislatures. So that led to Obasanjo to begin to prosecute opposition politicians through a commission called the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission. So gradually, large numbers of opposition politicians were under indictment, including the vice president. corruption is ubiquitous, universal, in a petroleum-exporting state like Nigeria, where almost all the revenue comes from petroleum, flows through the state. So this is quite common. You find it in Venezuela and other countries of the world. Obasanjo then selected, and first he made certain he controlled the dominant political party, the PDP, the People's Democratic Party, the ruling party. And then he selected a relatively obscure man in very poor public health, personal health, named Umar Yar'Adua. He has just been certified as the winner of the election. He is from a northern state, northern Muslim-majority state called Katsina. He has kidney disease. He had to leave the campaign trail in the midst of the campaign in order to go to Germany for treatment. It is rumored he has one kidney. It is rumored that he needs dialysis. In any event, this is perceived as a weak successor chosen by Obasanjo, whose party, the PDP, that he controls, has made him leader for life. So this is an example of authoritarian, oligarchic rule. The electoral process itself was described by the EU commissioners as a charade. Widespread fraud, more votes cast in some cases than people registered, a corrupt voter registry, the so-called independent electoral commission was a joke. It was completely under the control of the president. Ballots were not available. Thugs were common. There was probably 100, 200 people killed, 300 perhaps. No one's done the tally yet between the state elections a week ago, 10 days ago, and then the federal elections this last weekend. So this is one of the worst managed elections in Nigerian history, and there's been some spectacular competitive elections to compete against. So we are in a crisis in Nigeria. It is clear that there's widespread discontent. This is not regional or religious or ethnic. This is about democracy. All of the political candidates, because of a system of rotation they have in Nigeria between north and south, the unofficial rules of the game, are northern Muslims. The leader of the opposition is a man named Buhari, who ran against Obasanjo in 2003. He has vowed not to go to court, but to begin a popular mobilization. So the real question is whether the courts also will validate this election or not.
Mm-hmm. And I think I want to correct something. I misspoke. It is, in fact, the former vice president. He was the man who came in third. This was Atiku Abubakar.
Right.
So what the official, the quote-unquote official results were is that Mr. Yar'Adua got something over 24 million votes. Mr. Bukhari got about 6.5 million, and Mr. Abubakar about 2.5 million, and both of them have said that the governing party, the PDP, rigged the elections, and have said that they're not going to accept the results. It was interesting that President Obasanjo said his comment was something to the effect of, "Well, no, this was not a perfect election, but it was good enough, and we'll do better next time."
Yes.
What now do you think is likely to happen? And I suppose the question would be, do Mr. Buhari and Mr. Abubakar have enough support so that they could make some difference, or is this is it a fait accompli, and the PDP candidate will become president for as long as his health allows him to fulfill the duties of office?
My guess is that the opposition, it'll take months to go through the courts. The new president would be inaugurated on the 29th. What's most likely to happen is popular demonstrations, but I'm not sure that the opposition is sufficiently well organized to offer a nonviolent alternative, and then security forces, once conflict shows up, will put this down. So I think you have a illegitimately anointed president coming into power without widespread support. And then it depends on the ability of the oligarchy that runs the country to mobilize and distribute petroleum revenues in order to shore up the regime. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain what the – it's very soon after the election. I'm not sure what will happen tactically. I think all of the foreign observers, monitors, have rejected the election as corrupt. The most important internal group, the Transition Monitoring Group, has called for new elections. So there's going to be a call for new elections. That's what the key issue is going to be. So we'll have to wait and see. It's difficult to see how that would transition and go forward, but it's definitely going to produce greater instability in the Niger Delta and throughout northern Nigeria, where Buhari is very popular on the street and considered to be uncorrupt by Nigerian standards.
As you said at the beginning, the reason that this is important, that we should be paying attention to it, certainly is that Nigeria is a very large country. It's Africa's most populous nation. It has this very, very important resource base. And one of the reasons that it is, for good or ill, is of importance strategically to the United States is that now it provides significant oil, and we're expecting in the future that the oil that's going to come out of this region of Africa is going to be very important. So there are a number of reasons to be paying attention to this. And also, I think that at least going back some time, there was maybe some guarded optimism that we would see in Nigeria something that hadn't been seen before, and that was a transfer of power from one elected civilian government to another.
Yes.
What do you have some sort of sense of what exactly happened here?
Now, the ruling party, Obasanjo, began with an attempt on a third term. When that failed, he began indicting and blocking opposition candidates from running for governor or the legislature or his vice president running against him, by indicting them. And then a few days before the election last weekend, Atiku, as he's called, Atiku Abubakar, managed to get the Supreme Court of Nigeria to say that he cannot be removed from the printed ballots. So within a very short time, a week or less, the ballots allegedly had to be reprinted with Atiku on them. But that wasn't possible. So widespread reports all over Nigeria say the ballots were either stuffed, they didn't exist, people couldn't vote. The numbers that you repeated, the 24 million, are just fictions, I believe, creations of the PDP political apparatus, and have very little validity in my view.
So this, it sounds as if this was a fairly straightforward case of a party in power and leadership in power simply being unwilling to give up power.
Exactly. Widespread electoral fraud, intimidation, thugs, homicide. Mm.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Paul Lubeck. He is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is also director of the Global Information Internship Program and the Center for Global, International, and Regional Studies, all there at UC Santa Cruz. Someone who has been studying and following the politics of Nigeria for some time, as well as other places. He's done research there, as well as Ghana, Mexico, most recently Malaysia. And he's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just maybe we could shift over here a little bit and to talk about the interest of the United States in Africa, and something that we've been wanting to talk about here for a while, and that is AFRICOM. This is this newly constituted, or at least newly proposed, Pentagon Command covering Africa. This is something that was proposed last year, I believe, during the time that, at the time, Donald Rumsfeld was still the Secretary of Defense. And it was authorized by President Bush. In fact, the day that Rumsfeld left, and it would be due officially to come into existence in the fall of next year, fall of 2008. Initially, the idea that the command would actually be based in Germany, but eventually there would be command headquarters actually in Africa. So let me just ask a very general question. Why is it now at this point, do you think, that the United States is deciding that they actually have to have a military command whose area of interest is Africa, as it does in other places? I mean, why is it important that now we're saying we need to have this defense branch that's specifically focused on Africa?
There, if you go back historically, in the first draft of the report that we published, Convergent Interest, we do the history of AFRICOM, as we find that master's papers in training institutes in the U.S. military call for it, lobbyists in Washington call for it, that are neoconservative, and others that are associated with the oil industry. The existing system actually has three different commands, U.S. military commands, managing military affairs in Africa. The first is, and most important, is EUCOM, based in Stuttgart, Germany. That covers most of the North Africa, West Africa, and most of Central Africa. But then Egypt, all the way across, down through the Sudan, Kenya, is under Central Command. The Central Command is waging the war in Iraq. And then the islands, Madagascar and islands in the Indian Ocean, were actually covered by the Pacific Command. So this was considered very fragmented, problematic. Now, the shift is because of two geopolitical factors since 9/11. First is the instability of petroleum and energy supplies from the Persian Gulf. Now, they are unstable right now because it is self-induced by American foreign policy in the Gulf by intervening in a war of choice in Iraq, confronting Iran. This raises the strategic value and significance of West African oil. West African oil is especially valuable. It is light, sweet, as they say in the oil industry. More gallons of gasoline can be produced from a single barrel of oil. It has a transport edge. It doesn't have to go through the Suez Canal or around Africa. It's very close to southern U.S. where the refineries are, and it has now a security advantage. That's the first factor, what we call energy security. The second is the global war on terror, and the narrative, the doctrine coming out of the Pentagon, put forward by Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Teresa Whelan, W-E-L-H-A-N, calls for the problem of ungoverned space. So the Pentagon has come up with a doctrine that states the U.S. must contain ungoverned space. So if you look on a map, which we do in our report, that's available on line, the Center for International Policy, and that's www.cionline.org, you can see the graphics. The area they're talking about is equivalent to continental U.S., excluding Alaska and Hawaii. This is a gigantic area where they're proposing to spend $500 million in the Sahel, the countries above Nigeria, but now this includes Nigeria in the security zone. This is an area where people are starving to death, where there has been some terrorist activity, but very minor, where we are likely to provoke Muslim opposition to Americans rather than generate more security. There are two elements to the new threat paradigm, as it's called, ungoverned space. The first is the Sahara and northern Nigeria, if you look at these maps, produced by the Pentagon. And then the Gulf of Guinea, where there's piracy, were vast amounts of petroleum. In a presentation before the Center for Strategic and International Studies in March, Whelan announced that up to $500 million, 500,000 barrels of petroleum is lost daily in Nigeria through corruption. This is called bunkering. Oil is illegally gathered. There's a syndicate of criminals, many times working in collaboration with security officials. They take it in barges, put it in small ships, take it out the large tankers, and then the oil goes out into the international market. This allows vast amounts of arms to be imported to arm the syndicates and to maintain a shadow mafia-like government in the oil-producing region. This has also led to an insurgency called MEND and other insurgencies. So it's a combination of insurgency, a combination of crime, that and piracy that is threatening the security of this area. The threat is real. The question is whether U.S. intervention in the region is going to produce greater stability or have the U.S. become mired in another quagmire, as we find ourselves in many parts of the world.
What, perhaps I'm just being pessimistic here, but what seems to be, based on past recent history, more likely is that precisely, or at least I think that that's what a lot of people worry about.
Yeah, the probability is high, I would say, given the track record of the actors we're talking about. There have been, this trend is one you can see from 9/11 onwards. The initial interest is because EUCOM, which was managing the western part of Africa, based in Stuttgart, Germany, was beginning to lose its function. It was down to about a third of the number of troops after the Cold War. There was a greater concern about energy security and terrorism. But the problem with the military approach is that it provokes insurgency and opposition, especially in Muslim areas and also in areas like the Gulf of Guinea. So it's very tricky. What we argue is that the only solution is to compensate people in the Niger Delta for the destruction of their fisheries and of their lands, and to have a genuine development program for the Niger Delta. And to do that, you need genuine democracy in Nigeria. We have just witnessed the opposite, enormously, spectacularly corrupt election, reproducing the same oligarchy that's led to these enormous inequality and the abysmal record of Nigerian governance. And the key issue for American policymakers and for patriotic citizens is to know that only legitimate democracy, not searches for short-term stability, will produce energy security for the Americans in the long run, and that we need to support democratic forces and to develop Delta both economically and democratically.
We have a caller we will get to in just a moment. I do want to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Paul Lubeck. He's professor of sociology. He's director of the Center for Global, International, and Regional Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We're talking about Africa generally, Nigeria specifically, and about how that area of Africa is becoming an object of strategic interest of the United States. All of this, if you're interested, by the way, in some more background on these issues, you might take a look at a paper which our guest, Paul Lubeck, has co-authored that he's made reference to. The title is Convergent Interests, U.S. Energy Security and the Securing of Nigerian Democracy, an international policy report that they did for the Center for International Policy. And this report and other things there are available on their website. It's accessible, so if you have internet access, you can either go to www.ciponline.org, or you can just type Center for International Policy into your web browser, and you can find the site, and you can find this paper that was first published there this past winter in February. And questions here on the program are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here to bring into the conversation listening in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello, how are you? This is actually a really, you're right about the strategic nature of this, and it's strategic only because of the oil, but I'm always kind of in a quandary because I've noticed in the last 30-odd years, the Africans for Africa have sort of taken over, the colonialists have left, sort of, the companies haven't, but you know, all this meddling by the West, and I guess now even China has been, I guess the premier of China was in Africa a while back, you know, handing out money and signing contracts with all these people. But I'm wondering if I'm kind of in this quandary because you want these people to sort of like get their act together, like you were talking earlier about the political nature of not, you know, how this election is basically a sort of a fraud. But whenever you seem to watch it from a distance like we do, you see just incompetence, corruption. I'm not sure if the oil companies are involved in this. I don't know. I'm very confused about this whole issue. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. What's important also to realize, last year, just stepping back, is that I spent last summer doing an assessment of what are called the democracy and governance programs of the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. Now, this is the way in which small budgets are allocated to civil society and women's groups and education groups and that. So I spent I was a senior author on the report, and I spent the summer working on this. It's important to understand that the middle classes, teachers, and many of the farmers are in favor of popular, legitimate democracy. They have struggled for it. There are polls. One is called Afrobarometer, done by Peter Lewis, that show widespread support for democracy. The problem is the political elites control the system, and there are victories. The rejection of the third term last May is a major victory. We have to avoid what's called Afro-pessimism. The only way in which democracy and rights can be affirmed and supported is through popular mobilization and popular struggle to defend those rights. And this is an evolutionary process. We can't lose confidence, and we must act in solidarity with Nigerians and Africans as they attempt to have a democratic transition. You can find much optimism in South Africa. The achievements are spectacular compared to the fears with the end of apartheid. Ghana has done very well. Mali, Senegal are functioning democracies. It's a problem. It's a transition. And the situation in Nigeria is very complicated because you have 250 different ethnic groups, two mobilized religious movements, the Islamic revival, sometimes called fundamentalism, and the Christian fundamentalists are at each other. So to manage this is daunting. This would challenge even the most skilled diplomat and skilled Democrat. But the mobilization of the opposition, the transition monitoring group calling for new elections, are examples of the mobilized middle class that are demanding accountability. And I think that there's some optimism there as well as pessimism. What's important is for the United States to support the democratic forces. So you need to contact your Congress people, demand support for the legitimate election in Nigeria, if you favor that, but demand a accounting by the Obasanjo and now Yar Adua government, and not to pursue short-term interests of petroleum stability and security.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing I would say on that is I've noticed that when you're, I agree the middle class and stuff probably, I mean, they're rightfully, I rightfully support any kind of democracy anywhere, but I'm concerned about some of the leadership turning to the indigenous, I mean, stuff we don't hear because we don't have access to their media, telling people the West is meddling, the Americans, the Europeans, like Mugabe is always doing now, like, you know, killing half, you know, a third of his people, and everybody acts like in the West, like, oh, well, who knows? You know what I mean? But I'm just worried that Nigeria is going to turn into that because you can see from what I know of it, I don't know nearly as much as anybody like you would, but just on the surface of reading European journals and stuff like that and things like that, I'm just really pessimistic about it. I hope it gets better, but I really want to thank you. I appreciate your work.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks
Goodbye.
For the call. What do you think the likelihood, it seems to me to be remote, that the United States or perhaps even the United Nations would, with a kind of a unified voice, say to the ruling party in Nigeria, these elections were obviously flawed, and if you're interested in true democracy, what you're going to have to do is do them over again, and this time do them, you know, provide the kind of transparency and access that would make them an actual free and fair election.
I think pressure needs to be put on this government, given the spectacular fraud, violence, and mismanagement of the election. The exact nature of that is complicated. It can't appear like a quote-unquote neocolonial intervention. Mm-hmm. But practically, Nigerians are very pro-American. And they're not like Mugabe. They're not blaming. They want the Americans to live up to their principles and to support democratic governance.
This was an election where there are a lot of candidates. Is anyone in a position of making an educated guess as to if this was indeed a free and fair election, who would have been elected?
Difficult to know. Very difficult. Buhari, I think, was very popular in the north. He would have carried the northern Muslim vote, and he had some support in the south. The polity is quite fragmented. Atiku was off the ballot for a long time, so it was difficult to know. But Yar Adua had no charisma, no popular following. He was an obscure governor and then was brought up. And it was Obasanjo who was pulling the strings all the way through. So it's difficult to know.
Something that I know that you have studied and I'm interested in having you talk about is Islamist movements here and their significance, because I think that one of the things you're talking about, one of the dangers of greater involvement, particularly military involvement of the United States in the region, is would be to provoke Muslim opposition. How significant is in terms of politics are Islamic groups?
Okay, Nigeria is roughly half Muslim. That makes it roughly 70% Muslim, 70 million Muslims. That's larger than most Arab countries, possible exception of Egypt. So this is a major block of Muslims. The North was a separate political unit in the pre-colonial period before 1900. It had a Muslim state with Sharia law, Muslim law. It began in the 18th century. Reform movement and established a state. And then in the southwest, there are large numbers of Muslims. The largest city in Nigeria, Lagos, is assumed to be Muslim majority. It elects Muslim governors. So Islam is throughout the area, but it's very strong in the far north, and it's become institutionalized into the cultural practices of everyday life. After 1999 election, they introduced criminal law, Muslim criminal law. They've always had Islamic law beginning from the year 1100 in northern Nigeria, beginning in 1100. The British used Islamic law in the colonial period, did away with some of the extreme punishments, like stoning and amputation, but used Islamic law. And after 1999, they introduced criminal law to deal with the lawlessness, the crime, the corruption, and from the point of view of the poor, the expectation that they would receive Islamic charity. So it is what we describe as overdetermined in political theory. All of the different groups were supporting Islamic law. So the 12 states have Islamic law. It's important for Americans to realize this is conservative. This is an attempt to deal with law and order problems, widespread corruption, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, unemployed youth, and community policing. It is not my personal preference, but it is legitimate within these societies, and we have to deal with difference, that people are different in the world, and they cannot be pounded into a simple Jeffersonian package brought in by Paul Wolfowitz in Iraq, for example. This Sharia law is actually opposed to radical political movements and an attempt to control them. There are some rhetorically radical activists, and there are these almost messianic groups that occasionally rebel in northern Nigeria. They've been doing this since 1750 in northern Nigeria, and they will continue to do it. The great mistake that we made in the Cold War was to confuse legitimate nationalist movements and reform movements whose rhetoric might be anti-imperialist or anti-colonial with communist movements. If you need examples, I'll give you some, but I can't imagine people aren't aware of this now. That is the major error. When UCOM or AFRICOM perceives these groups as a threat or part of the global war on terror, and they train armies, they send so-called civilian well diggers, which they have in Nigeria that are military, health workers, and our teachers are from the military. The Americans are sending SEALs to Nigeria right now. They're planning an amphibious ship to be posted off the Nigerian coast. This is all found in a document by called New Inside the Navy. It's an online service. So all of this brings American troops with the global war on terror on their mind, where they are looking for terrorists. And when you look for them, you'll find them. And that is likely to breed conflict and difficulty for the Americans and the Nigerians.
And only to add to the perception that some people have around the world that for all of the talk that we talk about democracy, in practice, we continue to be, if nothing else, a kind of a neo-colonial force interested in basically in our interests.
Yes, what's happened is that what we call the human rights regime that was implemented, especially at the end of the Cold War, was a pillar of the Clinton administration, has been dumped in favor of the global war on terror after 9/11, with the Bush administration's doctrine of preemptive force, that the United States has the right to engage in force preemptively. The United States, the point of view of the Rumsfeld and Bush doctrine and Cheney, they have the right to chase terrorists anywhere in the world, including killing Americans that are associated with them, without trial. You saw an example of this in Ethiopia and Somalia, where the United States sent in special forces to Ethiopia, which is led by a Christian government, and then mobilized them, led them, supported them as they invaded Somalia to put down an Islamic group that was establishing order in Somalia. There are allegedly Al-Qaeda sympathizers or actors there. I have no doubt there probably are. But this example of moving Christians against Muslims, Ethiopians against Somalis, terrifies my African colleagues, because the political fabric of African societies are very fragile. if you're 50% Muslim or 40% Muslim, this could lead to widespread communal violence. And the ineptitude, the ignorance, the arrogance of civilian, political, and military officials is at the heart of this. I have enormous sympathy for the uniformed military and for all of the boys and girls that have been killed uselessly and maimed in this catastrophic war in Iraq. But it's the leadership that must be targeted as the threat to American security and something that must be changed in order to reestablish the principles and ideals that enormous members all over the world have admired America for implementing.
It just, I realize we're in a sense saying the same thing over and over again, but it just, it when you lay it out the way that you have, it seems that, our need for oil on the one hand and our preoccupation with security and terrorism as we define those things lead us in the direction to take action that where there is seems to be a very good possibility that, in fact, it's not going to lead to more stability. It's going to lead to less stability. It's going to lead to more conflict. We're going to get ourselves into even more difficult situations than we are now. The prospect for things going badly seems frighteningly likely.
Yeah, the United States has not maximized, begun to talk about a transition from fossil fuels that are melting the ice caps and on our way to frying us gradually. We have all this technology. We have labs. The University of California has many. They're beginning to move towards a sustainable future. This will be a vibrant industry once it's developed. Petroleum takes us back to 19th century imperial and 20th century imperial strategies. Because the United States has made a statement since the Carter administration that the Persian Gulf is a strategic national interest of the U.S., and that if the oil flows are stopped, it will be responded to militarily. And it's been affirmed by all governments. It's important that the Gulf of Guinea is not treated that way. The people that I'm sympathetic with and I've worked with in West Africa want their petroleum developed, but they want to benefit from this enormous amount of wealth that we outline in the paper. There are just, billions. We estimate that Nigeria between 2006 and 2020 could have $750 billion in oil income. What's necessary is a way to distribute this income so it actually benefits the population. This means public goods, education, health care, small-scale industries that actually employ people.
And of course, this is what has not happened in the past.
It has not happened.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Paul Lubeck. He's professor of sociology. He's also director of the Center for Global, International, and Regional Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He specializes in fieldwork in Muslim societies and has done research in Niger, in Nigeria, Ghana, Mexico, most recently in Malaysia. And I do want to mention again, if you're interested in doing some background reading on this subject that we've been talking about here, one thing that you could do, provided you have access to the Internet, is go to the website of the Center for International Policy. That's www.ciponline.org, and you can look for this paper. He is one of the authors, Convergent Interests, U.S. Energy Security and the Securing of Nigerian Democracy, that they wrote and posted there in February. Questions here are welcome, too. We have a couple of callers and about 5-6 minutes left in this hour of the show. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Let us talk next with someone who is in Newman. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I've been in and out of my truck all morning and didn't catch everything, but I was able to catch that last, I'll call it a diatribe against the current administration. And I just want to say thank you for stating it so eloquently. You did a great job, and there's a lot of people out here that agree with you.
Thank you very much.
All right. If there's no need for follow-up, then we'll go on to the next caller, to someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Since you touched on the war on terror, isn't the United States perpetuating the war on terror, creating its own enemies by plowing under the poppy fields of the Taliban farmers, and without any replacement of crops? So if I were a foreign citizen, and I'm sure many feel that same way, and my crops were plowed under, my cheap source of livelihood, I would tend to want to join the other side as well.
Yeah, I want to be clear that I think terrorism is real.
Oh, yes.
Political crime. We have to remember that after 2001, 9/11, the world was enormously sympathetic to the United States, and we have dissipated all of that, you say, moral capital. The problem in Afghanistan is extremely complex. We have ignored Afghanistan by this necessary war and intervention, this quagmire in Iraq. This has reduced the resources for developing some kind of representative democratic government in Afghanistan. We have produced a new series of warlords who are using poppies, opium, to fund themselves. So this is a part of a systematic foreign policy error. I think you have to be cautious about advocating or allowing the production of heroin. Downstream, it has a whole series of devastating consequences, and some alternative crop has to be developed.
But they're not supplying any substitute, are they? Not from what I've read.
No, they haven't been able to secure security in the area. The Karzai has very little authority outside of the capital, and it's a network of warlords in different parts of the country. So that it's a very weak regime. It probably couldn't. And the idea that the United States would have the resources and troops to go into a mountainous country and eliminate poppy growing is unlikely. They're able to do that. They may be opposed to it, but I don't. All the figures I've seen is that opium cultivation is thriving in Afghanistan.
I want to again thank the last caller and see if we get one more, someone who is calling from Chicago. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, certainly. I can really appreciate the information that you've been giving out, because what you've been saying, the American people don't get it. And what happens is the American people are not really concerned about foreign events, affairs, etc. And to those Americans, we must realize that the United States does not have the resources in order to go around and to stop every, what we would consider to be bad, regime. And in the case of Africa, especially Nigeria, where it's oil rich, that it appears that the Americans want to install or exhibit a colonialistic type of situation. And that's what actually happened in the case of Mugabe. The reason that he's so revered is because the Lancaster Commission back in 1982 was supposed to help him to pay these farmers where the land was taken from them. But actually, at that time, no black could own land in its own country of Rhodesia. So this is a whole lot of a problem. But I really want to thank you for what you brought out, because the information that you've been giving, the American people do not get this. We just sort of look at it's us against them. But we cannot rule the world. We don't have the resources. And what is happening is that we are suffering as American people right here in these so-called great United States. And I thank both of you for the information that you have brought to the American people. Thank you.
I appreciate the comment.
Just one comment.
Yes,
there
go ahead.
What's really important for American people to understand is that we have another department that deals with foreign affairs called the Department of State, and we are experiencing the militarization of American foreign policy. You have declining resources, declining prestige of the Department of State and our diplomats, the people that work on nonviolent solutions, the people that work on civil affairs, women's issues. They are being reduced in significance, underfunded, and the situation in Nigeria is not one of neocolonialism, but of oil companies in enclaves working to produce oil, paying off the local police and military, while the Department of State, the ambassador, John Campbell, who I've interviewed, I've given seminars to his people on my specialty, has the interest of Nigerian democracy, but is constrained by broader foreign policy issues with the present administration. But we need to return to diplomatic solutions. We need to think about more exchanges with people in Africa and to some collaborative way in oil-producing states where we set up trusts, where revenues can be moved into trusts, where the non-governmental organizations can manage and observe how the funds are moved to education, healthcare. Nigeria has vast amounts of natural gas associated. It's flared. There's permanent daylight in different parts of the delta. There should be a pipeline going around the country that would provide this cheap fuel for small-scale industries to employ people. They need to build a social basis for democracy.
We must stop there because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Paul Lubeck. He's professor of sociology at University of California, Santa Cruz. And I want to mention one more time, if you're interested in doing some background reading on some of these issues, you might look at a paper that he co-authored, Convergent Interests, U.S. Energy Security, and the Securing of Nigerian Democracy. And you can find this on the website of the Center for International Policy. That's www.ciponline.org. Professor Lubeck, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.